Welcome back. This is part two of CIOs and Bow Ties. Our guest today is Lex Sokolin, a fintech futurist and entrepreneur. And I know a dabbler, or probably more than a dabbler, in the venture space as it pertains to fintech, Lex. So tell us, as of July 2019, what excites you most in the fintech space right now?
What an amazing question. I think there are things that would be really interesting and fun to own, and it's impossible to own them. And then there are other more frontier ideas that I think are very compelling at least intellectually very interesting. So in terms of things that are very exciting and challenging on a global landscape, I'll point again to the large Asian fintech companies like Ant Financial, Tencent, and the others. And the reason they are so compelling is that they have the ability to combine media, technology, shopping, e-commerce, with financial services, including investments, banking, lending, payments, and insurance. And they're able to use all of your social and shopping and government and healthcare data in order to do that underwriting. Mm-hmm. And so this is, in many people's point of view, fairly dystopian as an outcome, especially if you're being watched by the Chinese government. But regardless, from a financial instrument point of view, it's a really compelling proposition. And the user numbers on these apps are really, truly staggering, mm-hmm. absolutely staggering, billions of people. And because the infrastructure in those countries is not as modern in many places as in the US, the pioneering companies can leapfrog. You know, they don't have to contend with credit cards because nobody uses credit cards or has them. Everybody scans a QR code through their phone. So that's, I think, fascinating in terms of where the U.S. Is very likely to lose over the next 5 to 10 years. And if you look at Facebook and its cryptocurrency, or if you look at other efforts by J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs to modernize themselves and reinvent themselves as these versions of Robinhood or Betterment or Acorns, I think the real competition is coming from the East, and our Silicon Valley companies know that. The other direction I can point to, and this is a little bit of a personality problem that I have, is that I'm really excited about the pioneering, on the edge frontier stuff. So for me, in 2009, when I started NestEgg, which is now Advisor Engine, digitizing the middle and the front office of wealth management firms at the time was very much on the edge. And I think today we see that as a mature theme that is ready for growth stage venture capital and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. But the frontier stuff today is pretty wild. And I've touched a little bit already on the blockchain piece and the digital assets, where the manufacturing cost of actually making financial instruments is trending towards being free. Mm-hmm. But other themes that I'm interested in our artificial intelligence and how that impacts security selection for fund manufacturing, or how that impacts insurance or lending underwriting. And we're seeing increasing use of that within the actual asset classes. And then the most out there thing that I'm excited about is the concept of new payment systems that would exist inside of mixed reality commerce. And so that I think is probably really far out for our listeners, but I'll just give you this analogy to seed the idea, which is when you introduce the web, a number of large e-commerce platforms sprouted, and those e-commerce platforms with them led to the development of new payments processors and gateways. And so PayPal today, or Stripe, or Square, multi-billion dollar companies that sit on the internet. And as we have new platform shifts, like the ones that Apple and Google and Microsoft are building towards virtual and augmented reality, I think we're going to have commerce that exists in those worlds. And I think new payment systems are going to come out of there as well.
Wow. Truly, truly spectacular. As you said earlier, amazing time to be alive. And I totally agree with that. Bit of a selfish question from me. So I mentioned earlier I was from South Africa, am from South Africa originally. And Africa in general is kind of the, you know, a bit of a lost continent when it comes to commerce. But it always strikes me whenever I go back to South Africa, you know, no matter who the person is, they seem to have a smartphone in their hand. And, you know, to me, that's akin to having some kind of bank branch in your hand or something like that. I know it's probably quite similar to the Asian or Indian experience, but I don't know if you've had any exposure in Africa, if there's anything unique going on there around microfinance or the unbanked segment of the population.
Absolutely. So the access to financial services and the ability to touch financial product is an amazing catalyst for economic progress.
Yeah.
If you look at, you know, the types of infrastructure that countries need to have in order to achieve certain economic growth rates and to bring up standards of living, having financial markets, having functioning non-corrupt banking, having property rights, all these things are, you know, basic requirements before you can take one step further. And I think the really interesting part of the African experience for me is that the players that are determining the future are different than the ones that you see in the United States, and even that you see in Europe or Asia. Okay. And so what I mean by that is, like, think of who determines how people have access to money or why they can bank or where that money lives. It's the government or the mm-hmm. sovereign and the central bank. Number two is going to be, of course, the financial institutions, which are licensed to do so. Number three are the technology companies. So in Asia, this is where the technology companies have had an opportunity to really step up, because the state-sponsored banks were essentially not serving the majority of the population. Mm-hmm. They're very slow, so the tech companies stepped in. In the US, the finance companies are very powerful, mm-hmm. and their servicing is good enough in most cases, and so people have little reason to switch or don't even see the rationale for why you would want necessarily a tech company solution. But the fourth pillar is the telecoms. So the phone is the hardware from a tech company, but the data goes over the telecom rails. Mm-hmm. And often the telecoms also bundle the phone into the sale. So the negotiating power of these four different actors is different. And in Africa, the telecoms are the in the power position for providing money services, because telephone minutes are used as a proxy for like a stable currency. It's a very mm-hmm. early version of digital currency. And so all of a sudden, you start looking at the positions of telecoms in other geographies. And in Europe, you see, I think Vodafone is, I might be confusing either Vodafone or Orange, mm-hmm. but one of the, you know, telecom providers is offering a free bank that people are just lining up and signing up for. And so it's this power play between these different players. And I think that's, to me, that's what sticks out the most. So if the right. telecoms are able to, you know, use the resources that they have to build financial services around that and get licenses on that side of the industry equation, then I think you can get a lot done. And of course, there's the Asian influence now that's quite heavy in Africa as right. China continues to invest there.
Well, I think it's Naspers, if I'm saying it correctly, in South Africa is a large owner of Tencent. So there's definitely that shareholding cross-pollination. Okay, let's one last question, Lex, and then we'll take a short break. But you know, I'm here in Atlanta. They call it Payment Alley. is a, you know, instead of Silicon Valley, they call it Payment Alley, just because of the volume of transactions that come through Atlanta. But on a different note, you speak about digital lending, and one specific company that I'm aware of here, just because it's merely based in Atlanta, is called Green Sky. And so maybe you can explain to us how a company like Green Sky operates, just generically. You don't have to focus on the company itself.
Sure.
You know, how direct lending works. And then I'm just going to throw in a slight nuance to that, and that is, I'm a financial guy. You know, my whole life has been trying to find investments for my clients. And it strikes me that when you have a lot of capital going to a certain space, whether that's subprime mortgages, whether that's crypto, you know, you just named the bubble du jour, that ultimately it, underwriting becomes weak and you have, you know, weaknesses and eventually, I don't want to say a collapse, but let's say a retracement as that capital pulls back. So the one thing that I'm thinking about is this volume of direct lending that's occurred, not only from digital side, but, you know, private lending, you know, how do, when the pendulum starts swinging the other way, how does one play it from a distressed perspective, I guess? And that's, you know, that's an open question whether you want to deal with that or not.
I'll give it a shot. It's a hard one. To start with the first part with, the concept of digital lending. So anytime there's a gap in the market or there is a little pocket of demand that's not being met, technology or just generally, you know, capitalist activity rushes in to fill the gap. And today technology is the form that activity takes. So after 2008, there were a number of different sectors where the traditional banks were not performing their industry function and doing underwriting. You know, student lending is one of those asset classes. So to give a tangible example, imagine you have $100,000 in student debt because it's sold to you, it's mandated to you by the government at 8%, you're paying at least 8% interest every year. And SoFi comes along and then takes that from you at 3%. So the moment you sign up, that's $5,000 in your pocket. And then of course, even more on a recurring basis. So the value proposition to a consumer is very compelling. And the default is, you know, is loaded on the back end. So from a P&L perspective, these companies appear better than things like robo-advisors or other services that promise you a future benefit far, far away. So digital lending has grown because the value has been so tangible. But what has happened over the last 10 years is that the product has shifted from being a destination you go to. So you would go to your local branch and try to get the loan, or you would go to the SoFi website and try to get a loan on that destination website. And instead, it has moved into the point of sale. So Green Sky does lending for home improvement, but it bundles the loan into the contractor. So you get the contractor and the underwriting is kind of bundled into it. You know, so they're still doing the lending business, but it's at the point of sale. Mm-hmm. And there are other companies like Affirm Fundbox, where for all sorts of different products, whether it's, you know, checking out a purchase on Amazon, and instead of paying immediately, you finance that purchase at the point of sale. The lending product is moving away from a destination you go to instead of being a feature of an actual commercial transaction. And this is happening across every type of sort of ticket size that you would pay for. The second part of the question is, what happens if all of this underwriting is bad, especially if the underwriting is done by a machine, which in many cases it is done by a machine? I think is a really great question. I think the good news is, at least as it pertains to digital lending, kind of personal and student loans, and even some of this residential stuff, the absolute volume is still not very large. So I don't think there is a systemic fallout from this yet. But on the other hand, there is a danger to the digital lenders from a collapse in the macro environment. So they do have this kind of financial risk embedded into the companies themselves. And then number two is all of the lending that's happening in the private markets, like you mentioned. So, you know, KKR underwriting corporate issuance as opposed to that corporate going to a bank and taking out a loan.
Mm-hmm.
That is a really big number. So that type of lending moving into alternative asset managers for sure is a big systemic risk. And I think people are certainly, you know, counting down until the implications of that become apparent.
Right. Yeah. Well, that for us is somewhere we're, you know, trying to put our research into and figure that one out when the pendulum does turn. All right, Lex, we're going to take another short break. We'll come back with part three, our last part of a fascinating discussion, and we'll be right back.